A plan to restore the faith of Harris County voters under election system can't come fast enough. Listen here, this is the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
There's no need to panic. The words of officials everywhere. But they're also saying there is a need to prepare. We'll tell you everything we know about the coronavirus right here. And switching gears, if you're struggling to find housing in Texas, you're not alone. Apparently, we are short by about 500,000 homes. And now that the waters of the election day have mostly settled, we provide some analysis and we'll throw in some inspiration as well. This is the Texas Standard. You're listening to the Texas Standard, where we all have PhDs in our love for Texas. If you don't have yours yet, keep listening. It's Friday, March 6th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. There's lots of news coming in today, but we left our bookmark in the story of coronavirus or COVID-19, and we're not done with that chapter. So that's where we will pick it up. With news that President Donald Trump has signed emergency funding to deal with the virus, a total of $8.3 billion, most of it, $7.7 billion, in the form of discretionary spending and about $500 million for mandatory spending through a Medicare change. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott held a press conference too yesterday. We're going to talk about that in a minute, but there's much to learn about the story, so let's bring in Dr. Peter Hotez. He's the Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. He's also the co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, and he joins us now. Dr. Hotez, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What are you hearing about different cities around Texas? How are they preparing for a potential coronavirus spread?
Well, you know, we've been predicting that we will start to see an increase in the number of cases in the United States, including Texas. Those that are imported from abroad, like places like China or Italy, and those in which where we're starting to see community spread. And of course, the second one is much more concerning because that means that we're starting to see the beginning of an epidemic take off.
So I see.
The one that we're worried about the most is seeing a scenario unfold like we have in Seattle, which would require large numbers of individuals who have to be quarantined and protecting our most vulnerable population. So for now, it doesn't look like we're seeing a lot of transmission going on, community spread here in the state. We certainly are seeing an increase in the number of cases, however.
Governor Abbott did come out yesterday and said that there are several cities that can now test. So how is that process working?
Well, you know, we had hoped that we'd be further ahead by now. The Centers for Disease Control and the federal government, and now with the responses being led by our Vice President, Mike Pence, has said that we'll eventually get up to 1 million kits. That's kind of an aspirational goal. I don't think we're going to, you know, the hope was we'd be there in the next week or so. I doubt that's going to happen. So for now, we're going to have to ration our testing ability, but it is slowly gearing up, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll be ready. I mean, remember how this works. It's, you know, just to put people a little bit at rest. I mean, I do think it's a very serious virus.
Sure.
In some ways more serious than some others are talking about. Just remember, it's not like you're going to wake up on a Sunday morning and find that all of San Antonio is infected or the whole eastern half of Texas is infected. You'll gradually see increase in number of cases. Then you may see the beginnings of community spread. But you do have time to see how this unfolds. And so the bottom line is, you know, don't panic, but be mindful.
What about potential vaccines, Dr. Hotez?
Well, we're a ways away. We have a prototype vaccine that we've developed, and we're now trying to develop a second one. So right now we're scrambling to see if we can get some support to move this into clinical trials. You'd think it'd be a no-brainer by this point, but it's still pretty tough to get funding to actually move things into clinical testing. We're going to have some modest funds coming from the National Institutes of Health to continue the work, but we're still looking for a larger amount to actually move this into clinical trials.
I see. Well, you were in Washington, D.C. this week, and what I wonder is about the federal government's plan addressing the potential spread of coronavirus. How do you feel about their plans?
Well, one of the reasons, this was to the House Science Committee, and a lot of it was around some of the complexities of developing a vaccine. That was my major testimony. But, you know, in the course of this, we had a pretty robust discussion about where the gaps right now and where we need to do better. And just to put things in perspective, you know, for a nation to fight an infection with a new pathogen is one of the hardest things that we can do. So it takes time to gear up. And I identified three gaps, three areas of vulnerability that I'm concerned about. One of them being our older individuals, those over the age of 60, because, you know, you're hearing different numbers on case fatality rates,
right,
but it's older Americans that seem to be especially vulnerable, just like it was in China. So the mortality rates are as high as 10 or 15%. And sure mm-hmm. enough, when this virus hit a nursing home in Kirkland, Washington, outside of Seattle, there's been 11 deaths so far.
Right.
So we can't let that happen again. So I've been really pushing hard to recognize the extreme vulnerability we have of our nursing facilities, our
Absolutely.
Assisted care facilities. So if the virus hits Texas, we'll have that same vulnerability. The two other ones I'm concerned about are our healthcare providers, because we saw in Wuhan and China, central China, a lot of healthcare providers go down with this virus, including some who were seriously ill. So making certain that all of our nurses and docs and mm-hmm. All the techs that you see in a visit to an emergency room or a clinic, making certain that they have the protection they need. And then I'm also concerned about our first responders. So those are the three things that they identified, at least on the early stages of this epidemic in the U.S., that we have to look out for.
We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Hotez. He's the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, and he's also co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. Dr. Hotez, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Here in Texas, officials have yet to see community spread of the coronavirus, but local leaders are preparing for that possibility. Many Texas labs are now able to test for COVID-19. KRA Saida Hassan tells us in North Texas, health officials say they're ready to respond to a potential outbreak.
A key part of preparedness efforts, increasing the capacity for testing. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced Thursday that six of the state's 10 public health labs can now test for the disease caused by coronavirus.
The remaining will be online by the end of this month. Once the other public health labs in the state complete the testing validation process and begin testing, the state public health lab network will be able to process more than 125 COVID-19 tests per day.
With limited capacity, Dr. John Hellerstedt says test kits are a precious resource. The commissioner of the Texas Department of State Health Services says doctors can determine whether patients need to be tested.
If the physician then in their judgment says, I really do want to proceed with seeing whether or not testing is appropriate for this person, we would ask them to contact their health department and we can have a conversation about it.
This week, Dallas and Tarrant counties announced they have the capability to test locally for COVID-19. Until now, local jurisdictions were sending off samples to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for testing. Getting results back that way took several days. Now, results could come back as quickly as the same day. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins is confident county leaders are prepared to respond to the possible spread of coronavirus. Jenkins points to the county's handling of the Ebola outbreak in 2014.
Many of the major players are the same. And so drilling together every year, having been through this, some of the players went through West Nile virus with us in 2012 as well. And so that gives you that confidence in each other.
Most reported cases of the coronavirus have been in China. The respiratory illness spreads from person to person. Symptoms can include fever, cough, and shortness of breath. For most people, the disease is not deadly. The outbreak is evolving rapidly. On Wednesday, state health officials confirmed Texas's first positive case of coronavirus outside of quarantine. The patient in Fort Bend County recently returned from traveling abroad. State leaders are now working to identify and monitor people who may have come into close contact with the man. But they maintain that the immediate risk to most Texans is low. Dr. Philip Wong is the director of Dallas County Health and Human Services. He says his department is preparing for any level of response that may be needed. Wong says emergency funding from the federal government would bolster those efforts.
Building our and supporting our laboratory capacity is one of the things. But, all of the other epidemiologic support, it's going to take a lot of manpower for the realities of whatever scenario may play out.
There's currently no vaccine for the coronavirus. Wong says local employers and school districts should plan for ways to accommodate what's known as social distancing if needed. That means avoiding places where people are in close contact.
You know, in schools, first you might make the class sizes smaller, put more space between the people, the telecommuting and teleworking for work sites. Those are all non-pharmaceutical sort of interventions that can be made. Then you start getting to closing public gatherings and not having those efforts.
Dallas County isn't taking those steps at this point, but Wong says having plans in place will minimize disruption in case of an outbreak. To reduce the risk of coronavirus infection, Wong encourages exercising the same kinds of precautions used to prevent the flu. Wash your hands regularly with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Disinfect commonly used surfaces. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Cover your cough, and perhaps most importantly, stay home if you're sick. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
He came in without touching his eyes. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor at the Texas Standard. How are you, Wells?
Doing okay. Surrounded here by wipes and disinfectants in the studio. Obviously, yes. Conversation.
Well, we're taking it seriously, though.
No, definitely so. Yeah. We've taken precautions here, and many of our friends and listeners are out there at this conversation about the coronavirus, seemingly everywhere on social media. On our Facebook page, Pat Snow is disappointed with the U.S. response to this. Pat writes that South Korea is testing 10,000 people a day, but we can't bother with that. This big conversation over the amount of kits being distributed to cities across the nation. Big conversation as well. Eric Ivan Garcia Rivera says, as a person living without health insurance and a food service job that doesn't offer paid sick leave, I can say that I am no place to get sick. Several more responses and lots more conversation on this topic
playing out
as well.
Especially in Texas, we have a lot of uninsured people. Keep it posted and keep it here. This is the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. We continue to report on the coronavirus from Italy to Washington State to right here in Texas. The story continues to evolve. You have heard there's no need to panic. Still, officials are recommending folks take certain precautions. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie has more.
First and foremost,
you want to wash your hands a lot.
Washing your hands.
Washing your hands frequently.
Really focus on that hand washing.
Well, we're continuing the message of washing your hands.
Everybody, from the President of the United States to the directors of health departments in Texas, wants you to wash your hands to protect yourself from being infected with the new strain of coronavirus. You should do it often and for a long time. How long? I asked San Antonio Metro Health Director Don Emmerich.
If you have children at home, sit at the sink and sing your ABCs with them. Do it four times. That's how long you need to wash your hands.
Really? Four times? I admit, that's a lot longer than I thought. Emmerich taught me something else, too. If you use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer,
allow the alcohol to dry on your hands. Don't wipe them with a paper towel. You gotta let it dry. That's what kills the bacteria.
Another tip, stop shaking hands. I know it seems rude, but infecting your newest friend with a novel virus is even more rude. Cherise Rohr Algarini is an epidemiologist in San Antonio.
Avoid the handshake, avoid the touching, avoid the hugging if possible.
Let's do an elbow bump. How does that work?
Do elbow bump?
Okay. But while better than a naked handshake, Algarini says both elbow bumps and fist bumps don't actually work that well. They still expose you to more risk than greetings where you don't touch at all. How about just waving?
When I'm passing people on the Riverwalk, everybody's saying hi. Mm-hmm. We're not shaking hands. We're just acknowledging each other with a hello and a nod.
Or you could do what Allegrini did when she lived in Thailand during the SARS epidemic.
You fold your hands together like you're praying and you bow.
Huh. That sounds a little like what I already do in yoga. And it'll keep my hands virus-free. Namaste.
All clean.
I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Hey, let me introduce you to a dichotomy. How can Texas lead the country in housing construction and, at the same time, have a housing shortage, a massive housing shortage? How is that possible? How are those two things true? Well, just to keep up with our current needs, we are 500,000 homes short. The numbers are highlighted on a new report from mortgage company Freddie Mac. And if you think it must be a Texas thing, it's not. Nationwide, we're lacking more than 3 million houses. And of course, the effects are high and rising housing prices and putting home ownership further out of reach for many. Joining me now is Steve Brown. He's real estate reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Steve, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Sure, glad to join you.
I wanted to bring some perspective to this. How does Texas compare with the rest of the country?
Well, we build a lot of stuff here. We always have. But we have so many people moving here. I mean, over the last 10 years, the Texas population has grown by 4 million plus people. And a lot of those are moving here. A lot of those are people born here. But we just can't keep up. We are leading the country in home building, but we cannot build at a rate to keep up with the population growth.
But where are these people living? What are they doing?
Well, some of them are doubling up. The last number I saw for millennials is still something like 20% of them are living in their parents' basement or whatever.
Right.
So that's what the situation. But yeah, there is a lot of doubling up. There's an awful lot of roommates going on. And there are a lot of people in apartments that would love to have a house. They just can't find one in any price range that they can afford. Statewide, we've got about a 3-month supply of houses for sale. Well, 6 months is considered normal. And, you know, in Dallas-Fort Worth, it's about 2.5 months. In Austin, it's only a month and a half supply of houses for sale. In the last 5 or 6 years statewide, we've seen prices go up by 50% or more in the metro areas. And if you really get down to affordable houses, say $200,000 or less, the kind of thing a first-timer would buy, there's just virtually no inventory. It's just not there. Most of the houses that are for sale in the state metro areas are higher priced stuff, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be the city reporter, and that was one of the major things that we always talked about, the lack of affordable housing, the lack of affordable housing. Things are not getting better. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, when you talk about places like California, places like Colorado, places like Florida, you're talking about places with a higher cost of living than Texas. Then what is missing in Texas? We don't have such higher prices of living. What's the issue here?
The issue is that the housing construction market, single family homes, really never has recovered from the Great Recession.
Mm.
Back before the recession, we were building like 170,000 single family houses a year in Texas. Last year, which was the best year we've had in over 10 years, we only built 130,000 houses. And for instance, in Dallas, Fort Worth, we built 35,000 houses last year. That sounds like a lot. Well, in 2005, 2006, we were building 50,000 houses a year.
So about half of where we used to be.
Yeah, but the builders, they can't get the labor. There's chronic labor shortages, but they can't find affordable land. A lot of the suburban communities have really made the entitlement process more onerous, so it's taken longer to get the zoning and the entitlements and things they need to do new neighborhoods. And basically, the housing industry is just not able to run at the speed it was able to run at 10, 15, 20 years ago, and that's why we're seeing these shortages.
Steve, is anybody thinking outside the box here? Are there any solutions on the table?
There's a lot of talk and consideration of doing things like granny flats, where you have a smaller house and behind your house or adjacent to your house.
Absolutely.
For an elderly parent or a young person, there's a lot of talk about using manufactured housing more. There's a lot of talk about using these tiny houses more. But the problem we got there is that the sort of NIMBYs, the people who already have their house, are real reluctant to go along with these kind of changes. And things are happening, but they're happening at a glacial pace. It's just taking a long time to get things done because everybody's got a house. It's not a big concern of them to have somebody else get a house. So, I mean, it's sad, but that's just where we are with that. Really, multifamily apartments are going to be the answer. Right now, we're sitting at about 40% of people in Texas are renters, and so whenever I hear people complaining about apartments and renters, it's like, well, that's 40% of the people that
that's
live in
right.
your town.
Absolutely.
They need someplace to live.
Steve Brown covers real estate for the Dallas Morning News. Hey, Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. This is something we're going to be hearing a lot more about in your next year or two.
That's for
thank
sure.
You.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott says emergency funding approved by President Trump this morning will help Texas respond to the coronavirus, which has been detected in at least 5 people in the Houston area. On Thursday, Abbott said the $8 billion aid package will speed up testing of suspected cases across the state.
We will be seeking as much as possible to ensure that all of these different regions will have the resources needed to respond to this as cases may arise.
Abbott says 6 labs in Texas are now able to test for the illness, and 4 more will be by the end of March. Officials emphasize none of the coronavirus cases confirmed in Texas are due to its spreading in local communities. The patients picked up the disease overseas. Texas congressman is urging communities of color to participate in the U.S. Census this year, despite failed efforts by the Trump administration to include a citizenship question on the national headcount. San Antonio Democrat Julian Castro says Texas stands to gain 3 congressional seats.
But if people are fearful of filling out the census form, if there's a severe undercount in the Latino community in Texas or in other places, that means that our state could lose out on congressional representation just because the Trump administration has played games with the census and tried to make people fearful of filling it out.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi also slammed Facebook for posting Trump re-election campaign ads that she said gave misleading information about the census. In response, the social media company is removing the post just days before the U.S. Census begins inviting people to participate in the survey. And Texas now has its first confirmed case of white nose syndrome in bats. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, the disease that's decimated bat populations in other parts of the U.S. is likely to spread.
Texas Parks and Wildlife confirmed a case of the disease last week in Gillespie County, but says it wasn't necessarily a surprise. The fungus that causes the disease, the one that turns bats' noses white, first appeared in Texas in 2017. Nate Fuller, Texas Parks and Wildlife's statewide bat specialist, says it was only a matter of time before the disease cropped up. The disease doesn't affect humans, but it can cause mass die-offs in cave-dwelling bat populations by disrupting their hibernation cycles and weakening them, ultimately leading to starvation. That could have implications for Texas agriculture, as bats feed on bugs like beetles and moths, bugs that can stunt or jeopardize harvests.
So without bats, we have a significant increase in the amount of pesticides and other nasty chemicals that we have to spray onto our agriculture.
White nose syndrome has killed millions of bats since it first appeared in the U.S. in 2007. Fuller says Texas Parks and Wildlife is testing around 30 bats in the central Texas area for the...
Andrew Weber reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. On Super Tuesday, no county saw more voting problems than Harris County, the state's largest county. There, some voters waited as long as 6 hours to cast a vote. So what happened? Well, for one, a county website did an update in real time. It sent voters to sites that were supposedly not busy when in fact they were too crowded. And then each voting center gave half of the voting machines to the Democratic Party, half to the Republican Party, but some places had 30 times more voters of one party versus the other. Here to talk about what happened, and more importantly, on the move forward, is Harris County Clerk Diane Troutman. Diane Troutman, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much, Joy, for having me.
Can we start with some of the basics?
Sure. I want to start by saying how much I appreciate the patience of the voters who waited in line Tuesday night, and also the dedication of all of our election judges and poll workers. They deserve immense admiration and kudos. What happened really was a combination of record turnout and the lack of a joint primary caused extremely long lines and wait times at some locations. So you could almost call it a perfect storm.
So for people who don't understand what a joint primary is, sure, what would that mean?
So last June, we met with both political parties to offer them a plan for a joint primary in 2020. This would mean one line that both parties can use, and they can use all the machines as well.
Sure.
We even set up a mock primary to show both parties the benefits of one line for all voters instead of two.
Mm-hmm.
We warned then that even with more equipment, two lines at each location would cause long lines and wait times. The election workers from both parties who attended this event agreed a joint primary was best. The Harris County Democratic Party agreed that was best. But unfortunately, the Harris County Republican Party refused. And in Texas, the primaries are run by both parties, so they must agree. So when they couldn't agree on that, the next best compromise was something called shared locations. And shared locations meant you had to have a line for the Democrats and a line for the Republicans. And both of those lines of machines could only be programmed for one party or the other. So you couldn't use each other's machines.
Let's talk about this part of the half and half, giving half of the machines to Republicans, half of the machines to Democrats. But in some places, you know, there's reports, the Houston Chronicle reporting that Democrats outnumbered Republicans by 2-1. So some machines were idle while others had no rest all night.
Sure. And we did this because with countywide voting, there is no way to predict turnout at polling locations because you never know where voters from either party will choose to vote. So we decided to have the equal allocation of equipment because there was no objections to the final recommended allocations on Election Day. We did deliver additional equipment to the Democratic locations that requested it throughout the day.
That was about
five locations, actually four locations out of 401.
How do you answer the charge when people feel that it is against the voters of color, that what happened affected people who have historically been affected in elections?
Well, I would say this. Before I took office, there was no polling location at our historically black college, Texas Southern University. But one of the first things my team and I did a month after I took office was to work with the Texas Southern University administration to have a location there. So this is only about the third election that we've held there. And again, from looking at the numbers during early voting at TSU, the average per day was about 50 voters, and I think one day was even zero voters. So it would have been very hard to predict that we were going to have the turnout that we did on election day and night.
At some point, you need to say, ultimately, I am the one responsible here. What can you do better next time?
Well, definitely going forward for the November election, we will have 750 polling locations, which is more than we had in previous administrations. And there'll just be one line, and all voters can, of course, use all machines. And voters can vote at any voting location since we had countywide polling places approved. We're also going to work on more outreach about early voting. We'll also be purchasing additional equipment in time for the November election. And as I said, we'll be meeting with community stakeholders and organizations on election issues and plans to improve access.
Diane Troutman, Harris County Clerk. Thank you.
You're welcome, Joy. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Screening can lead to early detection and is recommended for all men and women age 50 and older. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, honoring North American birds lost to extinction with the opening of the Lost Bird Project exhibition and the unveiling of the Eskimo Curlew Memorial Sculpture on March 29th. Galveston.com/Lost Bird.
My name is Laura Savage Rains, author of the book God Chose a Woman First. My book covers 13 women in the Bible whom God chose to be the first person to either experience God in a new way, to express a new truth about God, or to proclaim a new message from God. Everything from the first person to acknowledge God's role in childbirth, to the first person to break 400 years of prophetic silence from God was a woman, and the first person to announce the resurrection news was a woman. Our society, especially here in America, we were still shaped and formed by Christian culture. Even our calendars is still in reference to in the year of our Lord, 2020. That's also true in the laws that we've had for women. It took the women in the 1800s in America to finally say, look, women need the vote. And it didn't happen until 1920 because so much of the culture was still influenced by the biblical misinterpretation that women were to be subservient, that women were to always submit to men, and that men were supposed to be in charge. In the Bible, Deborah was chosen as a judge by God. And by that time, in world history, Egypt had already had two women pharaohs. So in my book, I like to combine secular history and biblical history and women's history. I think it's amazing that these stories were preserved. I mean, to think that it was probably male writers who wrote most of these stories. And so I believe they were preserved for a reason. And we have the opportunity to learn from them and emulate them. My name is Laura Savage Rains, and I am the author of God Chose a Woman First. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Past the hour, you're on Texas Standard Time. I'm Joy Diaz. A young black man named Devon Bailey was shot in the back while running from police in Colorado Springs, Colorado. That was last August. As part of an ongoing series, When You Look at a Gun, What Do You See? Guns and America's Lee Patterson has this profile from the neighborhood where it all happened. And there's a warning to listeners because the story includes sounds of gunshots.
What's this neighborhood called?
K-Land. Kmart Land.
Because there used to be a Kmart nearby, Dee Smith explains. He grew up here, loves the neighborhood. Dee's somebody who knows everybody. That's why he's showing me around.
This spot right here, that's where he was laying.
We pull up on a quiet residential corner. In the middle of the street, there are dark stains on the asphalt. Devon is written in purple. There's a memorial, some crosses, lots of flowers and candles. Dee didn't know Devon, but knows his family and says he was angry when he heard that Devon had been shot. Now, standing here, he's kind of speechless.
Because then you just imagine it could be me, could be my nephews, somebody else, friends that I know that's from the neighborhood, people I don't know. Just the fact that it's from here, it has like a little different meaning for me. I don't know. I just don't believe that the police should be killing people.
Colorado Springs 911, what's the location of the emergency?
It all started on August 3rd with a report of a robbery in the area involving a gun.
Hey guys, can I talk to you a sec?
Body cam video shows police stopping two young men, Devon Bailey and his cousin.
So we got a report of two people, similar descriptions, possibly having a gun, all right? So don't reach for your waist. We're going to just...
An officer approaches from behind. Devon turns, runs, and is shot four times.
Get your hands up! Get your hands up!
On the ground, police handcuff him. They cut off his shorts to remove something that looks like a gun from between his legs. These types of homicides happen. From 2010 to 2018, in Colorado, law enforcement agencies reported 352 officer-involved shooting incidents. Of the civilians involved, around a third were wounded and half were killed. That's 185 people who died.
In my experience, guns are everywhere. Everybody I know got a gun, even when I was younger.
Dee Smith says that white kids had guns, black kids had guns, not because of any real need, he says, but because kids thought guns were cool.
When you look at a gun, what do you see?
Immediately, anybody, I don't care who you are, if a gun's pointed at you, fear. It's always dangerous whenever a gun's pointed, but how I feel about it is a whole lot different if it's pointed at me than if it's pointed somewhere else.
2 years ago, Dee says that he had a gun pointed right at him.
My car got stolen.
But that's not where the gun shows up. Dee gets the car back, but the tires were damaged. So one night he says he and his dad are outside working on the car. It's winter, it's dark.
And the police rolled up on me and my dad while we were changing the tires. They already had their guns drawn, and I'm down. And I stand up and turn around, and the gun was pointing in my face.
The way Dee tells it, there's yelling. The officer is calling his dad a liar. He's yelling back, saying, "This is our car." Eventually, Dee's dad just stops talking. The officer gets a radio call that confirms this really is their car, and the officers leave. Dee says that his family never filed any sort of complaint, didn't think it would do any good. His mom did confirm hearing about the incident with police. His dad didn't return calls for comment. The Colorado Springs Police Department says that they do keep records of any time an officer points their gun at someone, and they have no record of this incident. Dee helps run a weekly mentorship group for boys. They talk about life skills, how to manage your money, tie a tie, deal with peer pressure. Tonight, it's at a barbershop. They're getting a music lesson from a DJ.
We turn it up. Now we can hear it.
So I went outside to talk with one of the boys, 13-year-old Tyson McKenzie.
I come to this group mostly to help other kids, but there's some things that I learned that I didn't even know. And we talk about touchy subjects such as this, like the police brutality and stuff like that.
Tyson says he was scared when he was watching the news and heard what happened to Devon Bailey. But he also feels that the police are there to protect him. He's young, and coming to this group helps him work things out.
My voice can be heard, and we can share our opinions with each other. Yeah, because we don't judge each other. Even if one of us has to cry, we all talk about it and we fix each other.
Dee and Prentice Wilson, the guy who started the group, haven't decided how they're going to talk about Devon Bailey yet. But earlier in the day, when Dee and I were driving back from the memorial, he did bring this up.
You know what? When I talked to you on the phone, I told you I ain't never had no good experience with the police, and that wasn't all the way true.
The bright spot? The Police Athletic League.
That was the best thing that ever happened to this neighborhood.
Years ago, Dee played baseball and football in the league. The program's no longer in operation in Colorado Springs, but back then, police coached and managed the teams.
Now they're getting to know us. So now instead of them pulling their guns out on us, they calling us by name and telling us, "What do you come here? Don't you run." That's the type of things that they need to bring back, because if they don't, there's no way of mending nothing together with no two people that are too different.
D. Smith sees the Devon Bailey incident in personal terms, as something really serious that happened where he lives. For Guns and America, I'm Lee Patterson.
Guns and America and our partner station KRA are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. Find more at gunsandamerica.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
I'm Sean Petrie. I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. In the Typewriter Rodeo, we make up poems on the spot on whatever topic people want. World War II veterans, requested by listener T. Rasko. You walk in a bar, maybe a new one downtown, maybe an old one that's been there since you can remember. And you see the people chatting, laughing, and clinking their glasses. Do they have any idea? The simple freedom to go where you want, when you want to, with whoever you choose, to cheers and joke about the weather or the government. All of them there, do they have any idea how close we were to losing it all? There's an old photo on the wall just beside the bar, a grainy black and white of a fresh face smiling, standing on the wing of a plane, a face that could be yours. And all these people have no idea. Yet you still raise your glass and give them a toast. And the rest of us, in bars and stores and homes all across the state, do the same for you and say thanks. For the Texas Standard, I'm Sean Petrie with the Typewriter Rodeo.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
That poem, of course, comes to us from our friends at Typewriter Rodeo, and if you got an idea for a topic, let us know. Send us your requests on social media or email. You can always do that at texasstandard.org. And we cannot wrap up this Super Tuesday week without checking in with Alex Samuels. She's the Texas Tribune political reporter. Alex, welcome back. You had a good week?
Yes, it was good. Long, of course.
Very long. We were watching dozens of races across the state, but I am very curious about your three big takeaways from Tuesday.
I'd have to say my first is the presidential race. I was actually at a Bernie Sanders watch party, and the mood throughout the night, it was just like being on a roller coaster. Everyone was super happy in the beginning because Bernie was doing well.
Right.
When early vote returns came in. But when election day votes came in, that's when Joe Biden really had a lot of his strength. And that's how he was able to essentially beat Sanders in the state of Texas.
It was a crazy night because you are absolutely right. I mean, some media was reporting, you know, Biden's big win. But in the end, there's only a 60-something delegate difference between the two.
Right. Yeah. So we got the delegate breakdown the next day. And you're right. It wasn't too big of a difference between them. I guess what was so surprising to me is that a lot of the polls leading up to Election Day put Sanders ahead of Biden. Some polls had him ahead by double digits. Mm. And so for Biden to just come back with those Election Day votes was definitely pretty surprising to me.
That's where the surprise was. What about the Democratic Senate primary?
Yeah. So that was another one. I would say that one wasn't entirely surprising. MJ Hager was the leading vote-getter in the U.S. Senate Democratic primary, and we knew that Tuesday night. We didn't find out until Wednesday who the second-place finisher was. Mm-hmm. Royce West, a state senator from Dallas, and progressive activist Christina Sinsun Ramirez were really neck and neck for that second and third place spot. But Christina ended up conceding on Wednesday, and we saw that Royce was ahead. So now we'll see Royce West and MJ Hager face off a little later in the year.
I was thinking about other surprises for you, for example, the Railroad Commission.
Yeah, that was a big surprise.
Whoa.
Not only for me, but for,
for him.
A lot of folks
yes.
here in Texas. Yeah. Yeah, he was an incumbent. He had, I think, Ryan Sitton, we had in our story, he had $2 million in the bank. He had endorsements from Greg Abbott, Dan Patrick, Ted Cruz, John Cornyn. And he, as you said, he was an incumbent, and he lost to a guy who had about $13,000 in the bank.
Right.
And little to no name recognition, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, the Austin American Statesman was reporting that Jim Wright may have won because of his name. And I was thinking, what does his name have to do with anything?
Yeah, I think we and also the Statesman reported that there was an old House speaker by the name of Jim Wright. So I don't know if people thought
some
they
confusion.
Were voting for him. Yeah, oh. I really don't know what led to Ryan Sitton being defeated, but it's definitely fascinating to watch.
Alex Samuel, thank you so much for doing this. She's political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Thanks again.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, welcome back.
Joy Diaz, good to be back.
I mean,
good to be back on this Friday, this beautiful Friday.
But time flies, though.
The end of the week.
Sometimes it flies, sometimes it stalls.
Sometimes it crawls.
It does feel like time flies because the show goes by so fast.
I know, yeah. Well, here we are. Yeah, end of the week, end of the show.
Yeah.
We should revisit something we heard earlier in the program. We heard from Harris County Clerk Diane Troutman speaking about just those incredible lines, those scenes from Houston on primary night, people waiting as long as 6 hours to vote. We talked about some of the impetus for that,
yes.
What happened and the controversy with the parties and these separate Republican and Democratic
right.
lines to vote, basically. Well, she came out with a statement while we were on the air.
Very candid,
very interesting. I'll read just a portion of it here. She says, "We did the best with what we had and what we believed was fair and equitable by allowing equal amounts of equipment to each party. However, we take full responsibility for the long lines and wait times and apologize to the voters and the communities who were affected." So, really kind of sort of the buck stops here type statement.
And you know what?
There.
Sometimes I feel like no matter, well, I was going to say no matter what you do, but what you do is important. But I also feel like taking responsibility for what you do is as important.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
I
so.
Always admired that my dad could apologize.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a skill that seems to be vanishing in this day and age.
We're bringing it back.
There we go. I like that. Well, you know, golly, look at that clock ticking down.
Is it telling you something?
It is. I was going to mention something. I don't know if
Please
we got
do.
Time to get into it, but another interesting story. Sunday, International Women's Day.
Yeah, tell
this
me more.
This year's theme. It's interesting. It's each for equal, a gender equal world. Can be healthier, wealthier, and more harmonious, say the event organizers. So what's not so great about that? Good question.
I'll tell you something really sad that I read on The Guardian.
You told me about this.
Oh,
this
God.
Is messed up.
Okay, there's a report by the United Nations Human Development Report Office, and they published this report. They polled people in 75 countries, okay? So it's not, you know, a minute report. And they talk about how 80% of the global population live in those countries. Well, the majority of people believe men are superior political leaders. More than 40% believe men make better business executives. And almost a third believe it's okay for a man to beat up his wife. Guys, let's change things. Come on. I challenge you to do that. The weekend is upon us. This is the Texas Standard. Thanks for listening. I'm Joy Diaz, in for David Brown.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.